Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in Fort Virginia Prescott. 40,000 African Americans died fighting during the Civil War. Nearly 400,000 signed up to fight during the First World War in segregated divisions, and more than a million enlisted in World War II. Fighting for our country has often been seen as emblematic of America's best qualities, qualities like valor, courage, and a willingness to fight for American values. But history shows that instead of being honored, African American veterans have been disproportionately attacked, beaten, and lynched, a horrific trend that ran through Reconstruction, Jim Crow, and continued even after the Allies defeated the Nazis in 1945. Last year, the Equal Justice Initiative's Lynching in America, Confronting the Legacy of Racial Terror, was able to document some 4,000 lynchings throughout American history, around 800 more than previously reported. Recently, EJI released an addendum to last year's findings titled Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans. Brian Stevenson is an attorney, author, and founder of the Montgomery, Alabama-based Equal Justice Initiative. And Brian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Glad to be with you.
So this report begins with the end of the Civil War and emancipation, a war that black men actively participated in and where I mentioned 40,000 lost their lives. What was the national response to black military veterans, many of whom actually returned south after the war?
Well, I think there were two responses. I think the North largely retreated from the commitments they made to full emancipation for not only black veterans who fought for the North, but for all emancipated people. There was a Civil Rights Act in the 1870s that was designed to give black people the right to vote, protect them from violence and terror, empower them to build lives that other immigrants had experienced in this country. But all of those laws were struck down by the United States Supreme Court. The White House under Andrew Johnson was more intent on bridging gaps and mending relations with the South. And so emancipated people, including black veterans, were largely abandoned. The Southern perspective was to maintain the narrative of racial difference that had sustained slavery. And the great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude. It wasn't forced labor. The great evil of American slavery was the ideology of white supremacy, this idea that black people weren't fully human, that they weren't capable of responsibility and governance and all the other things that citizens enjoyed. And so after emancipation, there was a real need to invest in a new way in this idea that black people were inferior, not the equal of whites. And you saw that manifest with the violence, the terror, the subordination of people of color. And there was no community that was a bigger threat to this narrative of racial difference, this ideology of white supremacy, than black soldiers, people who had actually armed themselves to fight for their freedom, who showed valor and courage. And they became the primary targets of a lot of the violence and terror that shaped the collapse of Reconstruction following the Civil War.
How were you able to piece together these stories? There's so many examples and historical points that you point out in this report that show black veterans being targeted for lynchings, for beatings, for various kinds of assaults. Were you looking at firsthand accounts or newspapers? How'd you put this together?
Well, the tragedy is that we really haven't been able to put together the full story. There were thousands of people who were targeted for violence whose names and stories will never be known because they just weren't deemed newsworthy. They weren't deemed important enough to even be documented in a meaningful way. Beginning at the end of the 19th century, the public spectacle lynchings, the activity of communities to organize and gather to carry out this violence became too much of a topic for local newspapers to ignore. And so you do start to see coverage of some of these lynching events in local newspapers. That's a source of a lot of the information that we rely on for the report. There are then archival files. There was a code that forensic experts would use when they were documenting the death of a lynching victim. They would say things like, died at the hands of persons unknown, or the descriptions of the cause of death would confirm that this person had been hanged or otherwise beaten to death through mob violence. And into the 20th century, the documentation of lynching picks up. in the early part of the 20th century, the NAACP organizes primarily to detail and document these lynchings. And so the black press begins to really focus on these stories and becomes a primary source of the information that we rely on. And the later we get into the 20th century, the more we're able to then tap into oral histories and narratives from family members and community members that could detail some of these experiences.
Now, when you were looking back, were you able to find white supremacists explicitly stating that they were targeting black veterans? Or are you looking at the numbers and sort of saying, you know, all the reports of lynchings that we can find, many of them are veterans and they're being disproportionately targeted?
No, there's a great deal of evidence that black veterans were targeted. So many people were lynched in the American South, not because of an accusation of a crime, but because of some violation of a social convention. And soldiers returning from battle in their uniform would command respect. They would generate attention, as white soldiers did. And that was a threat to these narratives of racial difference, to this ideology of white supremacy. So we have accounts of black veterans being told to remove their uniforms in public or to disarm in public. There were orders issued in some communities that black veterans had to turn in their weapons. Black soldiers were told to deny their military service. And oftentimes, if there was any kind of resistance to this humiliation, that would lead to violence, and these soldiers would be beaten or lynched or victimized. So many of the accounts that we detail in our newest report are accounts that are generated by an encounter, a confrontation that was specifically about the military service of the person who then is murdered.
I'm speaking with Brian Stevenson. He's an attorney and author and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. They recently put out a report called Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans, that looks at how black veterans were targeted for lynchings and attacks from Civil War all the way up until World War II. Now, the Union Army was initially reluctant to let African Americans fight in the Civil War, and you write that that changed as casualties rose, even then under discriminatory conditions. That really seems to be a theme when you move forward and look at World War I and II.
Yeah, I think the United States government understood that empowering black people to serve in the military was going to complicate the Southern narrative about black identity. And it was an American narrative, too. I mean, we didn't in anywhere in this country fully value the rights of African Americans in the early part of the 20th century. That's why the military was segregated. That's why we didn't permit in the early goings black soldiers to fight in combat. But as the dynamics of the war became more challenging, of course, you were trying to win the war. And like what you see in contemporary athletics, I mean, nobody in the South wanted black athletes on their college football teams or basketball teams. But as you get pulled into the challenge of winning, you do what it takes. And that led to the integration of college athletics. And a similar story can be seen in the earlier history around black military service. So more and more of these black veterans were called into more demanding, more skill-specific roles. By World War I, there were fighting units from Harlem and other black regiments that were distinguishing themselves through outstanding military service and having success on the battlefield that was being recognized by Europeans and other allies that didn't make the distinctions that Americans made between black soldiers and white soldiers.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. We return now to our conversation with attorney, author, and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevenson. We're talking about EJI's new report, Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans, and the violent homecoming black military veterans have faced throughout the 20th century after combat. The prevailing narrative in American history, I think, at least from, you know, from what I experienced growing up, is to look at the end of the World Wars as these times of victory and celebration. But from an African-American perspective, that narrative is a lot more complicated, and I think these pieces often get left out of the history books or are relegated to a footnote. Tell us a little bit about the Red Summer of 1919.
Well, W.E.B. Du Bois had actually encouraged black people to join the military because he believed that it would prove to America that black people were capable of exercising other rights and responsibilities, and it would help the call full rights, for full protection. And as black soldiers returned to the United States following military service, what it did was trigger a lot more white fears that this newly empowered, trained black community was going to be a threat. And so there was this idea that if we don't subject black people to more rigorous scrutiny and control and subordination, they're going to riot. They're going to push back. And these threats and these rumors of armed resistance to white control created a very tense moment that became manifest in what's called the Red Summer of 1919, where white mobs would organize in response to any kind of rumor that a black person had done something threatening to a white person. And what would come as a result of these armed mobs going into the black community would be these horrific mass atrocities where dozens of people would be killed or shot or run out of town. You had whole sections of communities across the country rounded up and forced out of their areas. And in places like Elaine, Arkansas, where over 200 people were killed over a three-day period, to communities around the country, there was this tension, which very much related to black military service during World War I, which created this fear that black people were now going to arm themselves and revolt against Jim Crow and segregation.
It's hard to imagine. You know, we often think of our veterans as being asked to make a sacrifice unlike any other. It's hard to imagine deciding to enlist and potentially make that sacrifice for a country that doesn't afford you full rights. You mentioned Du Bois, but how did soldiers themselves actually view this promise of military service?
Well, I think, you know, when you're constantly humiliated, when you're constantly told that you're not really a man or you're not really a full person, where you're desperately trying to prove your humanity, it's frustrating. I mean, there's a burden that you have to manage, and it wears you down. And so I think for soldiers who then took on the double challenge of combat duty and fighting to keep America safe and free, to come home and still be treated in this way, I think psychologically it became very overwhelming for people. And you saw black soldiers doing things that other black people might not do, questioning why they have to go through the back, questioning why they can't buy a soda or coffee, questioning why they have to get off the sidewalk when other white people, many of whom didn't serve in the military, hadn't made the commitment to a freedom that they had made, walk by. And those questions would create conflict, and that conflict would create violence. And this escalation in terrorism and lynching in the early 20th century was one of the manifestations of that era. And it is terrifying. I mean, you know, older people of color today come up to me sometimes and they say, I get angry when I hear people talking about how we're dealing with domestic terrorism for the first time in our nation's history after 9/11. For that generation, it is deeply disruptive and offensive to hear us talking about this first experience with domestic terrorism when they had to survive terrorism on a daily basis. They had to worry about being bombed and lynched and menaced every day of their lives. And the growing frustration of having to live in the margins of society, having to deal with the indignation of Jim Crow and segregation, having to be minimized in all the ways that black people were minimized in this country, just grew harder and harder for those who had risked their lives to preserve this country's freedoms. And that was true after the Civil War. It became more true after World War I. And by the time we get to World War II, where there'd already been activism around creating greater equality, to have those promises yet unfulfilled, I think it was really overwhelming for soldiers.
So would you say that in spite of this history and this the growth of terrorism after each of these wars, would you say that the history of African-American servicemen really did end up having a great impact on civil rights?
Well, I don't think there's any question that many of the civil rights activists and leaders that resolved to fight Jim Crow and segregation developed that resolve after serving in the military. Hosea Williams was a powerful civil rights leader who served in World War II, and his military service was key to his commitment. He came back to Georgia, was beaten by a mob of white people because he wore his military uniform, and it just concretized for him that if he was willing to die for the United States in Germany, he had to be willing to die in the United States for freedom to black people. And that will to fight, thinking strategically, thinking about the consequences of particular activities and activism, all, I think, shaped the civil rights movement.
We are speaking with Brian Stevenson. He's an attorney, bestselling author, and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, who recently released a report titled Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans, which takes a look at how black veterans were violently targeted from the Civil War up until World War II. Today, where we're looking at a lot of ways in which the institution of slavery, Jim Crow, how even after, you know, some of the more concrete pieces of these institutions have fallen away, that the echoes still remain today in ways that are still incredibly concrete and sometimes a little less tangible. How do you think that the legacy that this report examines, how is that factoring in for African-American veterans today? It's hard to imagine that this history doesn't still echo in our armed forces.
Oh, I don't think there's any question that this narrative of racial difference that really shapes American history is still alive, continuing to shape a range of contemporary issues. And I don't think that we're going to make the kind of progress we need to make in America until we own up to this history. Look, we're a post-genocide society. Before white settlers came to this continent, there were native people who were thriving, and we slaughtered them by the millions through famine and war and disease, and we actually haven't acknowledged that destruction because we said, no, those native people are different. They're savages. And we use this narrative of racial difference to justify that treatment. It's that narrative that sustained American slavery for centuries, that created this black-white divide. And in many ways, we haven't confronted that narrative. It dominates the development of the early part of the 20th century and terrorism and lynching and violence, which we have not really fully acknowledged. You know, it took us 15 years to build a memorial to 9/11 victims, which is appropriate, but we've yet to create those spaces to honor those thousands of people who were murdered during the terror acts surrounding lynching. Even in the civil rights space, I think we have been too celebratory. We haven't actually talked about the intense resistance to civil rights by state elected officials, many of whom still exercise power today, who have found new ways to resist integration. And I think there has always been a presumption of dangerousness and guilt that gets assigned to black and brown people in this country. I think that presumption is at the heart of the police violence that has generated so much activism in the last couple of years. The reasons why people of color are disadvantaged and discriminated against in our criminal justice system, are at risk when they encounter the police, are targeted in our schools around these policies that create pipelines from schoolhouses to jailhouses, have everything to do with this history and our failure to acknowledge it. Part of the reason why we put out these reports is that I think there is work to be done to talk more honestly about the plight of black veterans throughout history, to acknowledge that we failed in many ways to honor and respect the service of these veterans. And when we start doing that, I really think we begin to lay a foundation that might get us to some place where we can truly claim to be free and just. But without that, we're not going to make the progress we need to make. If you go to South Africa, you can't spend time without hearing about apartheid. If you go to Rwanda, they will make you understand the legacy of genocide. In Germany, you can't go 100 meters in Berlin without seeing markers and monuments that tell the story of Holocaust victims. There is a Holocaust memorial there. In this country, we've been largely silent about the legacy of slavery and terrorism and segregation. And that silence condemns us in many of the contemporary policy discussions and debates that we have today, where race and racial bigotry and racial bias frame and shape those debates in ways that haunt us. And so, yes, I think this legacy, this history, very much is evident in the many of the issues that we're talking about today, and can only be addressed when we talk more honestly about their roots, which began with the genocide and slavery and terrorism and segregation.
Brian Stevenson is an attorney, author, and founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, authors of Lynching in America, Targeting Black Veterans. Brian, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Glad to be with you.
You can find a link to that report and more of EJI's work at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. According to a study by the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute, the gap between chief executive pay and average worker earnings grew from a multiple of 20 in 1965 to nearly 300 in 2013. People have come to expect wide pay gaps between CEOs and the rank and file, even if they don't like it. But in Portland, Oregon, companies will be seeing consequences for inequality. There, the city council has recently passed a surtax on companies whose CEOs make more than 100 times the average wage for workers at that company. Gretchen Morgenson is a business reporter for the New York Times and co-author of Reckless Endangerment. She wrote about Portland's new surtax on companies with extreme wage inequality. And Gretchen, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Happy to be with you.
So this move has already passed a vote in city council. How exactly does it work?
Well, there is a business tax in Portland, Oregon already, and that makes it much easier to just assign a greater tax to certain companies, in this case, companies that have a wider pay gap than others. And so it works easily for them because they are already levying a business tax on companies that operate and that have a generate sizable sales in the Portland city area.
So is this for local businesses specifically or also for sort of national and international corporations that might be doing business in the city?
Oh, no, it's public companies. So, okay, it's not private companies. This would be large, the Walmarts, the Costcos, the Amazons, you know, the very well-known companies that we know. So it really applies to multinational corporations who do a lot of business in Portland. So, you know, Starbucks, you know, think about any major corporation that is who would be subject to this tax.
Any sense of how many companies that will actually affect?
Well, they told me that they currently get or generate taxes from about 550 companies doing business in the Portland area. And they also estimate that the tax, which would be a tax on a tax if the CEO pay gap is very wide, would generate, they estimate, between $2.5 million and $3.5 million a year. So while that's not going to really break the bank at some of these large corporations, it is going to generate, fairly significant revenues for the city to be able to, you know, pay their firefighters more or their policemen more. So that's an interesting element here also.
Yeah, and you also write that it coincides with a provision of Dodd-Frank, which will actually make it easier to know which companies this applies to.
Yes, it actually arises out of the Dodd-Frank law, which required the SEC to demand companies, you know, to calculate what the pay ratio is of the CEO to the average worker. And so that rule is coming into effect in January of 2017 for the first time. And so for the first time, investors will be able to see every year in the proxy statement that a company, a publicly traded company, files, they will be able to see what the CEO makes compared with the median pay of the remaining employees of the company. This is the first. Dodd-Frank required it. And so Portland, knowing that this was coming into effect, said, well, we'll just take a look at that pay ratio that's required under the new SEC rule, and then we'll be able to target the companies that have the excessive ratio or pay gap.
Now, the Portland Business Alliance, which is a group of nearly 2,000 businesses, they oppose the tax. Has there been any discussion of unintended consequences or, you know, threats about businesses moving or talk about having to let go of workers that a tax like this is actually intended, I assume, to protect?
Well, that is one of the criticisms of this, that companies will be driven away from doing business in Portland. It would be interesting to see if that actually happens. As I said earlier, the numbers are not that enormous, so I don't think that it's really going to be a deal breaker for these large companies. You know, if you were a small employer and, you know, it had maybe a couple of employees or a generally very small business, yes, it could have an impact on you, but I really don't think it could have, you know, that sizable an impact on these behemoth companies that do business all across the country.
Well, and I think you would be very, very hard pressed to find a small business that can afford to pay its executives 100 times more than rank and file.
Well, that's the interesting thing, too. Portland cited some studies that show that the publicly traded companies, you know, pay far, far in excess of what the median employee is paid. And the average or typical small business, you know, salary is just very nominal, very nominal. So you're right about that.
Is anywhere else in the country looking at a tax like this? Is this a first of its kind sort of thing?
This is the first of its kind in a city. There have been state legislatures that have tackled the idea of maybe, you know, penalizing or, on the alternative, rewarding companies who do not have a large pay gap. But none of those bills have ever passed. And so this really is the first of its kind.
Yeah. How's the general public feel about it? Is this seen as symbolic or seen as an actual way to raise money?
I'll tell you, I think that what people, at least judging from my email inbox and judging from Twitter and Facebook responses, you know, I think people really feel that there is something out of control about executive compensation at some of these public companies, and that any kind of way that we can, you know, even just get people talking about it is a positive move, because it has just done nothing but go up in the decades, you know, that I've been covering business. And, you know, when you have a situation where the CEOs are making these massive multiples of what the rank and file workers are making, and the rank and file workers are having trouble making ends meet, I think that just makes for a very, very difficult environment. And the polarization and the gap between the rich and poor in this country, I think, is a topic of great interest and something that we should, you know, try to deal with in a better way.
Gretchen Morgenson, business reporter for The New York Times and co-author of Reckless Endangerment. Gretchen, thank you for joining us.
Anytime, Taylor.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. And now it's time for The Bookshelf, the series where NHPR's Peter Biello speaks with writers who are local to New Hampshire and sometimes who just love to write about the Granite State. This week, he's speaking with author Brendan Du Bois.
Exeter, New Hampshire author Brendan Du Bois has just published his 10th mystery novel, featuring the magazine writer and former Department of Defense analyst Lewis Cole. The novel is called Storm Cell. We've heard Brendan Du Bois before on this podcast talking about his previous Lewis Cole novel, which was called Blood Foam. And for this interview, we thought, let's do something a little different. Let's get out of the recording studio in Concord and go to Brendan Du Bois' writing studio in Exeter, where, as he put it,
it's where the magic ha-ha-ha happens. A lot of times it's desperation, a lot of times it's pulling at my hair. But yeah, this is my office, such as it is. Used to be a bedroom, and now it's packed with books, paintings, plaques, souvenirs, and an Apple MacBook Pro, where I spent a good chunk of my time before, every day.
And on this day, as we spoke, his Springer Spaniel, Spencer the Wonder Dog, lay at Brendan's feet. The office was packed with books, shelves piled high with them, everywhere.
This is truly a writer's studio.
It is. And a few years back, I was at a mystery writer's convention where the New York Times bestselling author who writes the Kinsey Millhone mystery, Susan Grafton, someone asked her about, you know, what's your favorite place in the world? And she sort of looked embarrassed. She says, I just love my office. And, you know, that's a woman who worked in Hollywood, has been all over the world. And she just short and shyly said, I just love my office. And I have to agree, when I get in here, it's, on the good days, it's like, it's a wonderful place to be.
I'm looking at your computer here, and you've got a sticky note on your computer monitor that says, make it worse, tension on every page. So is that your modus operandi? That's how you go
one
about it?
One of my modus operandis, a few years back, I took a writing seminar from Donald Moss, who's a literary agent, author, and someone who's writing workshops. At the time, I thought my writing needed a kick. I was sort of had plateaued out. And one of the things he taught was, yeah, tension every page, make it, you know, make things happen. Each page should contribute something to a work, either propel the plot or examine something about a character. But it should not be a wasted page. Like some beginning authors always tell them, stay away from weather, stay away from architecture, get to the meat of the story. And that's sort of a constant reminder.
So I'm picking away now at your sticky notes, getting insights into your writing life. And another one says, no more one-shots. Is that writing related as well?
Yeah, no more one-shots means no more trying to write something quickly and off the cuff, put some thought into it. For example, this is not a boast, it's just an acknowledgement of fact. I've had 150 short stories published. And the thing is, when you go to our number 151, don't just do it off the cuff as a one-shot. You know, put time into it. Make you believe that it's picture number one, or story number one, I'm sorry.
Is that an attempt to make sure that you don't sort of rest on your laurels, or just keep you on your toes? And
keeps me on my toes and keeps me fresh. A lot of times when you've been in the business, a lot of writers, sometimes, I wouldn't say rest on laurels, but, and I'm not going to name names, but they tend to get lazy, and they tend to repeat stuff, and that's something you just got to guard against. Being a published author is a wonderful thing, but you always have to put that behind you and say, what's the next book? What's the next work going to be?
So let's talk about Lewis Cole, because he's now on his 10th book with you.
Sure, number 10, Storm Cell. And what's different about this book is a lot of times in previous works, Lewis has been the one in trouble that he needs help. And in this case, it's his friend who's in trouble, Felix Tinius, who's the sometime mob enforcer, part-time security consultant. And in chapter one, he's on trial for murder. And what's funny about this book is that you'd think Felix, who has helped Lewis in many, many occasions, would welcome Lewis's help, but the exact opposite happens. He refuses the help. And that's sort of the mystery that starts the book off. Why won't Felix take Lewis's help?
Mm-hmm. Did you know the reason when you started the book, or did you sort of discover it along the way?
You know, I knew the reason, and I'm going to confess, I did not know who the real killer was until like I was halfway through. I'll say, oh, that person will fit the bill, and which sounds silly, but a lot of times when mystery authors plot out books, they tend to leave that open, thinking that if they don't know who the murderer or the main character is, who's the bad guy, that the reader won't know, because how can the reader know if the writer doesn't know?
Mm-hmm. I have to say that I didn't see it coming.
Well, thank you very much. It means I'm still doing it with book number 10. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and assume you have more planned for Lewis Cole.
Actually, Lewis, the next one, the book tentatively titled Hard of Ground, is with my publisher now. So I'm keeping fingers crossed that he enjoys that one. I'm also working on a novel, and it always strikes me odd when I say this. I'm working on a mystery novel with New York Times bestselling author James Patterson, and I'm hoping that gets completed by early next year.
One of the aspects of Storm Cell that I found interesting was that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you raise the stakes of the story by throwing into the mix the idea that there are developers on the horizon who want to put a casino on this fictional coastal New Hampshire town and change the character of the town. Is that something you have strong feelings about?
Yes, I do, because I think a lot of times developers, when they have good intentions in heart, can come in and do something that has unanticipated consequences. And Hampton Beach, or as I call it in my works, Tyler Beach, has this weird mix of funky yet old-time New England and maritime history that I think is something special. And there's nothing on the horizon now for a casino going there, but I could see it happen. And that's one thing that I address in this book, is the problems associated with something if that were to happen.
Why do you think people 10 books in are still so fascinated by and interested in a character like Lewis Cole?
That's an excellent question, and I'm always happy that there are people interested in Lewis Cole. And I think part of it is that I've made the attempt over 10 books to change him, to grow him, so that he's not stuck in amber. And another thing is that he has faults. He falls down. He makes mistakes. And I think part of it is that he's exceptionally loyal. The first few books, I think he was more of a bitter loner, but he's grown to get close to a certain circle of friends. And if something happens, he'll drop everything and will do what it happens to make something right for his friends. And he won't let anything get in his way.
Mm-hmm. A little background about Lewis Cole. In this book, Storm Cell, he is sort of an unemployed magazine writer, but he has a history working in the Department of Defense.
Right. He's a retired research analyst many, many years prior. He was on a top secret training accident that killed everybody in his group except him, and that's something that's haunted him all the way. And he was a magazine columnist for a number of years in my books until, again, you want to mix things up. He got fired, so he's on his own. And in a prior book, his house was damaged by a fire. So as someone says, sometimes you have to kill your darlings or make them suffer. And again, I think that's what brings people to the books, is that he's an enduring character.
Yeah, I found myself admiring him for his loyalty. And, you know, he's not invulnerable. He's unemployed and he's physically hungry because he doesn't get money to buy the kind of food that he would normally want to buy.
He's unemployed and he's waiting for a big insurance payment. And sometimes insurance companies sometimes drag their feet. And every day he goes to the mailbox hoping that the big check will be there, and it's not. And he finds himself, you know, pinching pennies and doing things. And that's when, you know, the rubber meets the road. How far will you go? And he has to take care of his friend, even though he's stretched out tremendously and really is under a lot of pressure.
What kind of comments do you receive about him from your readers?
A lot of positive comments like that. That's saying, you know, I wish I had a friend like Lewis, or I wish I had a family member like Lewis. Most of my female readers, bless them, love Felix Tinius, the sort of anti-hero, because Felix is loyal, but he's also a much better cook, and he's more handsome than Lewis. And he's much more, shall we say, physically agile if violence erupts. But, you know, you get people who say, I'm tired of the landscape. I'm tired of Tyler Beach. Can he go somewhere else? And one reviewer says, for God's sakes, get him the insurance check already. I'm tired of hearing him whine about it. So, you know, you can't please everybody. But then again, you know, that's what happens when you enter fiction.
Well, the lack of the insurance check, I mean, it's for me, it's like him against this massive faceless thing that has so much control over him.
Right. And I think in these times, I think most people can relate to that, you know, waiting for some big bureaucracy to sort of belch forth a settlement or a doctor's appointment or some bit of news that you need. So I think that makes him more human, makes him really admirable to my readers.
Mm-hmm. Is that something you sought out in a character, something that would make him relatable in that particular way?
I think it grew along the way. As everything, you know, sometimes you get life experiences or you see other people's experiences, and as the book develops, you say, well, let's bring this in, let's bring that in, making it more three-dimensional, more real.
Mm-hmm. NHPR has another podcast called the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, mm-hmm. and they ask the same sort of questions to authors every week, so I'm going to steal one of their questions
for you.
And that question is, which do you find more difficult to write, the first sentence or the last?
Oh, boy, that's a very good question. I will lie. I find the middle. The first one, because usually it's been banging around in your head for a couple of months that you know how you're going to start the book to grab the reader. In the end, because as you're churning along and you have these months of work behind you, you know pretty much how it's going to wrap up. But the middle part, I think, the middle sentence, the middle works, that's when things start to sag and you got to really dig in deep, because you're inviting a reader to come along with you on this journey. And if you grab them at the very beginning and you're satisfied with the ending, you need to keep things up during the middle.
One last question, and I'll since we're in your office, your writing studio, I'll ask one about that. How much time do you spend in this particular chair working on your books?
Several hours a day, but then again, it's flexible. Today's Wednesday, which means it's laundry day, so later today I have to fold the laundry. I also take Spencer out for romps, you know, do groceries, but usually I'm in my office first thing in the morning. Do a solid 3 or 4 hours, take a break for lunch and other things, and then I'm here in the afternoon. And much of my wife's dismay, sometimes the laptop comes downstairs and sits in my lap. And that's when I answer emails, do a little research, maybe do a little editing, polishing, working on a short story, something like that. So I'm pretty connected here in the office.
Well, Brendan, your faithful readers are looking forward to Lewis Cole's next adventure. Thank you very much for talking about Storm Cell.
Thank you, Peter, very much. Thanks for coming down here on such a snowy day.
And that was NHPR's Peter Biello speaking with local author Brendan Du Bois for The Bookshelf. Thank you. Thanks for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear, Jason Leonard, Broke for Free, and Jazar. There's much more to hear and explore at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can listen to the show anytime, on demand, on your schedule, with the Word of Mouth podcast, which you can find by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.